Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 144, with guests from E-Man's Movie Reviews, Emmanuel Noisett. Also, J.R. Forresteros from The Storymen and probably every other podcast on the planet. So listen up, because we've got a really relevant show for you. On this episode, we talk Detroit and when the gospel gets political. But I do think that this has the potential to be a very interesting episode. I'm actually a little hesitant because I think it would be real easy for us to kind of retread a lot of the same ground when we talk about a movie like Detroit that we did at a glance when we kind of dove into Get Out. And I think if we are kind of lazy, we're hitting on that, but I think it actually brings up some pretty separate conversations, which is one of the reasons I want to talk about Detroit, because I think it's not just about the movie, but it's about how the movie was made. It's about who made the movie, what audience that movie is for. And one of the most interesting things to me is if we look around at what's going on at the time that we are recording this episode, it almost feels like Detroit, for all its positives and negatives, is timely and is hopefully starting conversations that we should have been having all along.
So. I guess I felt really differently about the movie. I felt like this was about, I don't know, 5 years too late. Mm. And I don't know that it actually added. And like at this point in 2017, if this movie surprises you, then you literally have just not been listening for the last at least 3 years, minimum, like if not much longer than that, in my opinion.
So I guess that's one of the first things, and a lot of the reviews that I read, I guess the first question I'm curious is, like, even though it's gotten a lot of positive reviews, it's still got a pretty high, you know, Rotten Tomatoes score. It's still making people ask, like, who this movie was made for. Mm. So E-Man, I'm kind of curious, like, when you left Detroit, the movie, not the city, when you left Detroit, like, did you wonder at all who it was made for?
I would say that I didn't wonder who it was made for, only because I was more so appreciative that the story was being told.
Okay.
Because it was a story I wasn't familiar with. I didn't grow up hearing it. I didn't learn it in school. I mean, I knew of the Detroit riots. I didn't know of this particular situation. And it's one of those things that I'm always appreciative of learning certain things that I didn't, you know, normally I wouldn't have the opportunity to learn about. And I'm also appreciative of the fact that other people are going to learn about it as well. I kind of had similar feelings when Hidden Colors, what is that it?
Hidden Figures.
When Hidden Figures came out, I was like, oh my gosh, this story is amazing. You know, like, I want the world to know about this story. So while this story was remarkable, it's not something that, you know, you want to, it's not going to be uplifting in a positive sense, but no, it is enlightening, I guess, just in terms of just being aware, you know, that stuff like this happens. And I think this is what Bigelow was trying to go for, but not only did it happen in the past, but it's not that unfamiliar to what's happened in more recent times, you know, because we have a lot of situations where people like to envision a post-racial society in America, And, you know, it's not really like that, you know? I mean, it can if you live in a bubble, but for other people, like minorities, people of color, things haven't really been that different. They've just been, they've shifted, you know? So I appreciated that this film was made, because my hopes were that everybody, you know, of all backgrounds could watch it and come away with the same thing, as in, hey, we've got problems, and they didn't magically stop once Dr. King was assassinated. You know, like, things didn't just magically get all the way better. We've made progress, but we're not where we need to be yet.
Yeah. And so if you look at the things that Kathryn Bigelow has done, she's teamed up with Mark Boal, I'm guessing, for Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker. These things that typically be very visceral, like portraits of humanity doing things that the average person doesn't do. Or the average person doesn't find themselves, you know, like, we're not Navy SEALs. We're not trying to, you know, murder or capture the biggest terrorist in the world. You know, we're not disposing of IEDs on the side of the road, like putting ourselves in someone else's shoes. And I feel like one of her strengths is putting you in the shoes of a character or multiple characters in a situation, whether it's historical or just this emotional and heavy moment. But that aside, I was kind of wondering, like, what is she trying to do? Is she just trying to tell the story? Is this supposed to stir us to something else? Is this just supposed to remind us? Because, I mean, a lot of the reviews I read almost described it as like torture porn, just to almost shock white people into realizing like how bad things were or are possibly now. But like you were saying, Eman, like, people who still experience this, it's not really that much of a surprise to them.
No. Did either of you get that sense of the torture porn sentiment?
I did.
Okay.
I didn't feel like this movie told me. So I didn't know the specifics of this story. But even given that, this film did not tell me anything about race history or race relations that I did not already know. Mm-hmm.
When I watch Zero Dark Thirty or I watch The Hurt Locker, like, intellectually, I know the events that happened. I read reports, I have seen documentaries, you know, I know mentally what happens. But like I said, I think Kathryn Bigelow's talent is bringing this almost visceral reality to it. So even though you're admitting that it didn't tell you anything you don't know, JR, did it give teeth to those things? Did it make them more real at all?
No. I mean, I
guess you already there.
Yeah, like, I was already on board, you know? Like, I already agreed with the statement the movie was trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that makes me atypical for your average moviegoer. But again, I have heard and seen this story again and again and again from my friends of color. And yeah, there just wasn't anything that I was like, wait, what?
Mm.
So I think one of the things that I thought about when I left the film was one, that it seemed very uneven. Like, it seemed like I was watching a couple different films. There was this film in the middle that, again, I'm not sure exactly what the point would have been. And maybe it's because I also believe that, like, people have been systematically or directly oppressed in our country for various reasons for all of its existence and before. So, like, seeing something visceral like that, it had me on the edge of my seat. I thought it was very suspenseful, but it didn't like surprise me. But it was captivating watching it, like not knowing what was going to specifically happen next. But then once it gets out of that house scene, we're moving into like this courtroom drama that lasts like 5 minutes, it seems like. And then it kind of rushes to just kind of tell us what happens to people. And we see a little bit of almost this PTSD situation with one of our main characters, and no resolution really to some of our other characters that we've been following. And I felt like I watched some very skillful filmmaking in the center of the film, but at the same time, I didn't leave like I did with like I said, a movie like Get Out, and say, oh, like I see what he was doing there, or at least as much as I can, I see what he was doing there. And I'm kind of curious, like I know JR, you were on the Get Out episode as well, so I know you've seen Get Out. E-Man, I'm assuming that you've seen Get Out as well.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So in your opinion, like what is the biggest difference between a movie like Detroit and a movie like Get Out?
Well, Get Out to me is a far more layered movie than this is. Because I completely agree with your assessment of Detroit. It did feel like three movies all in one. You know, given the beginning and the middle and the end of it. Are we doing spoilers? I forget.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, there were definitely three layers. But you know, with Get Out, I mean, one of the things that I've always told people about it, about that movie, is the fact that you can watch that movie right next to someone else of a different ethnicity and walk away with a completely different perception, and neither one of you are going to be wrong. You know, like it just has that much that, you know, your personal experiences are going to shape how you view that movie. I mean, I was talking to some people, other film reviewers from the UK, you know, and these are people that just have not experienced or, you know, they didn't really get some of the nuances and stuff that was happening, because, you know, while racism and discrimination is universal, it's not specific everywhere. You know, like, it's not always the same thing. It's not uniform. So, you know, when they throw a joke and Get Out, like, oh, I voted for Obama three times, or I would have, you know, that's an American joke that people would get for subtle racism. But if you're in the UK, that might just go over your head. But with Detroit, I mean, I think it was simpler. And to kind of go back to what you asked before about what was Bigelow's intention, I was fortunate enough to attend a Q&A where some of the actors that came out to talk about the film and everything, and they basically reiterated the fact that, you know, she wanted to tell the story. Like, that was her main prerogative, was to tell this story that has very few you know, historical documentations, or, you know, I mean, some of the living survivors are still there, as some of the movie indicated. But, you know, the story in itself is not one that was readily made known. And the actors talked about how Bigelow had a difficult time in trying to, you know, collect information about the film. And, you know, there were just certain gaps she had to use her own interpretation, you know. But yeah, I think the difference is Get Out is not trying to tell you one singular story the way that Detroit is. And that would probably be the biggest difference. Detroit wants to tell you, this thing happened. Oh, by the way, this stuff is very reminiscent to what's going on today. While Get Out is talking about more general issues around a specific topic, which would be subtle racism.
So you're actually using, you actually said that Detroit is trying to kind of maybe open our eyes a little bit to the fact that like things like this still happen today. Okay. And JR is saying that this Detroit feels like a movie that's 5 years too late.
I agree. I mean, well, the thing is that, well, both are true, you know,
yeah.
Because the stuff that's happening today is stuff like this is no different than what this could have been compared to the L.A. riots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this could have been compared to the Rodney King beating, you know, like this could have been easily compared to what happened in Ferguson. So this isn't, it's timely for some people, but it is long overdue, I guess, you know, in many other cases. So
JR, when you say it's probably 5 years too late, or you say it is 5 years too late, like, what do you mean? Like, what's the difference between now and 5 years ago?
I think the cultural conversation around systemic racial injustice and the continuing legacy of slavery has moved way past where this film is. In fact, one of my biggest problems with the film was that the first, I don't know how long it was, 15 or 20 minutes that was like just the riots.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man.
Gave no context at all.
Oh man. Are you sure you didn't read my review? You sure? Oh, you know that boy. Oh, continue. I mean, I'm sorry. Go on. I'm sorry.
We like the same kinds of wings. We like the same.
We do like the same kind of wings.
That's just what it is. Like,
the kindred spirit. It's true.
Well, no, I would say that's. I mean, I'm assuming that you're talking about how if like someone who has no context for this historically, the way that it had the preamble, the artsy preamble, but outside of the artsy preamble, it looks like, hey, if you're black and you live in Detroit, you just like to riot because you don't have anything better to do.
And you heard the same in the film. You actually heard the same thing, which was like, how come black people are all burning down their own buildings?
Right.
You know, which again, if you fundamentally don't understand what rioting is,
yeah.
Right? That famous, again, another King quote that riots are the language of the unheard, right? And this film did nothing to address that. And again, 5 years ago, before the rise of Black Lives Matter, before Ferguson, before Baltimore, maybe it could have gotten away with that and still at least been moving the conversation forward. But mm-hmm. at this point, it feels like it's actually dragging the conversation backwards.
Well, I'm actually interested in you exploring that further. Like, how does this drag the conversation backwards?
Because I think it wanted to present what happened at the Algiers Motel as part of a larger race issue. And that's why it opened with the riots. But mm-hmm. by not explaining how riots in American urban centers, again, like all the ones that Eman just listed, right? What happened in LA, all that stuff. Without explaining how those are the eruption of decades of systematic oppression that actually go all the way back through Jim Crow to emancipation, then what happened at the Algiers just looks like, hey, here was this one crazy time that some stuff got out of hand.
Yeah.
Like, and it was a bad police officer who, see, he had already been censured and he probably shouldn't have been allowed to go back out on mm-hmm. the street. And at the end of the movie, the other detective called him a racist F-bomb. So like, it's okay. And it completely removed the systemic qualities from issues of race in America. And where our conversation is right now, where Black Lives Matter has sort of forced us to begin talking, is how are there systemic issues of race that until they are addressed at a systemic level are like these kinds of things are going to keep happening over mm-hmm. and over and over and over again. And you didn't get the sense that this is something that will inevitably happen again.
Yeah.
You got the sense that like, man, those guys sure got a raw deal.
Yeah, I definitely feel like it opens the way that the film portrayed the situation without actually going back and explaining the riots themselves, or at least giving any more context than it did, because it felt like it did It asked, what was the bare minimum we can do before we get to this really tense, like, middle meat of the film? Since it basically was asking, what's the bare minimum? It made it look like, hey, because I mean, even all the other cops, almost every other person in the precinct was like, this guy's bad. We all realize that racism is awful. We're all like going to punish him for this thing. And it's mainly just this guy and maybe his one buddy and then his dumb friend. Like, it's not systemic, like you're saying, Jared.
And again, if they hadn't opened with this sort of like quasi-animated artistic storytelling motif, I would say, well, maybe they didn't have any idea how to do this.
Well, you know, okay. Like, first of all, let me piggyback off of all of that, because that was one of the biggest criticisms that I had. I mean, the moment I saw it, instant eye rolls, because I'm sitting in a crowd, and it was fairly, you know, a diverse group of people, and I'm, you know, I read the little disclaimer preamble or whatever, and immediately I'm thinking, no one is going to remember what this says, because I don't know about you, but I rarely remember what those things say in the beginning anyway. And but yet we get like that 15 to 20 minute, you know, dedication to showing black people looting and rioting and all this stuff. And, you know, if you really do a little research on this, you'll know that where Bigelow decided to show was the tipping point. You know, that wasn't the catalyst. That wasn't like the first stone thrown or whatever. That was the tipping point when there have been multiple harassments of police and multiple cases of just like police brutality and things like that. So, you know, that in itself was something that was, I thought, a bit irresponsible as a director. And it will kind of go back and touch on that other article we were talking about. Should white filmmakers tell black stories? But I won't go into that yet. But yes, this does contribute to a bigger problem, which is about representation, because I remember when Ferguson was happening and the riots were happening, and, you know, I saw the media coverage and I saw how some of my white associates and friends were, you know, how they were just like, oh, I can't believe these people are acting like animals and this and this. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you have no idea what's like fueling them. And no one is, you know,
people aren't telling the stories.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's just one of those things, like, riots are, no one sits there and says rioting is a good thing. But if you don't understand the riot, then you're that's also a part of the problem, because you can't just assume that people just riot just for the sake of rioting, you know. And this film missed a huge opportunity to, you know, just like JR said, to give it some more context. You know, if you can dedicate 15 minutes of showing them doing that, then show the other side of that too, or just take it completely out, because we really didn't need all of that. You could have just given us a whole preamble of the entire situation and then jumped to the motel.
Yeah.
You know, if you really wanted to tell that specific story, because now I have to really question, why did you include that at all?
Well, what it reminds me of, and if you want to actually get into this particular conversation, you can just listen to sports radio for like 2 seconds. But yeah, when you're talking about people not understanding or where people are coming from, or those stories really not being explored, it reminds me of like the controversy right now over NFL players kneeling during the national anthem in protest.
Oh, man, don't go there, man.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So like, we don't need to like,
we can, but yeah.
I mean, but that's to me is the same concept. People are so hung up that people are protesting that they can't, they never stop to say, why are they protesting? Like, they're so offended.
I think that the right way to protest is you get tiki torches and wave Nazi flags. Yeah. And then
that's freedom of speech. Yeah. That's freedom of speech.
Then there are multiple good, fine people on all sides. But if you kneel, then really bad.
So remember that time we lost like a third of our listeners?
Listeners get pissed because I'm calling out hypocrisy. Bye.
This is why I have the best guests. I love it.
Really tremendous guests.
they're, if you left, it's sad. Very sad.
Everybody is saying Real World has the best guests.
That's right. So I'm kind of curious, like, again, like, we're recording this podcast a number of days before it'll actually release. So as we record this, you know, we're still in sadly the aftermath of events like Charlottesville and controversies over, like, Confederate statues and, the leader of the country not condemning outright people who are white nationalists and, you know, Nazis. And it has drawn this divide right down the middle of the country. Well, actually, I think it's not even there in the middle of the country. It's kind of like to one side, because I don't really believe
to the far, far, far right.
Yeah, I mean, because I really don't feel like 50% of the people in America are okay with Nazis. And I know even saying it like that will trigger some people to assume that I'm using a particular rhetoric or language. But I mean, this is what we're talking about right now.
I mean, you were just identifying the flags they were flying.
Yeah. So, I mean,
if someone says they're a Nazi, just believe them.
That's not hard at all.
Yeah.
White people do have a problem believing people, though. I think that's also clear. Right.
Well, so. They elected Trump, so, you know. Yeah, I went there.
Yeah. Yep. This happened. I went. There's so much realness on this episode right now. So this is kind of what I mean. I don't want to do two things. I don't want to be flippant about any of this stuff, and I don't necessarily want to fully take the gloves off, because I do want to talk about this in a way that is constructive, not just sure. That is airing our grievances. Because following both of you guys,
it's not Festivus.
Well, it's not Festivus. Yeah. I mean, and if it was, we would probably, like, you know, no one likes Festivus. Those people, they don't even worship the right God. Because I mean, like I said, I follow you guys on social media, and I mean, I follow a number of my friends on social media. And a lot of this has already been aired out. So I'm hoping that, again, I don't want to dodge. I don't want to pretend that it doesn't suck, because it does. And I don't want to pretend like people aren't divided about this, because they are. But I feel like Detroit in and of itself is a movie about concepts that are still at play in America. And like I said, one of the main reasons this is timely and not just would have been great when the conversation was different is because I feel like people need to have more conversations about race.
Absolutely.
And because we need to have more conversations about race, I'm actually really curious, not just like, do you think what's going on is right or wrong? Are you mad at the president because he didn't say the right thing? I think, at least from the three of us, we all are. I know some people aren't quite as mad, or maybe aren't mad at all, which would be very odd, based on most of the interactions I have with people who listen to the show. But I want to know how our faith, it helps us have a better conversation about this. Because I think starting with our faith will help us hopefully start to lead out of it and not just be snarky, even though sometimes we feel like snarkness is the only way to get through. So like I said, I understand we're upset. I understand that things suck, because they do. But JR, like, how does your faith help you wade into events post Charlottesville? Even though, like I said, I think we can readily admit that it shouldn't have taken something like Charlottesville for us to have these conversations. It's not like Charlottesville was the first signal fire.
It didn't. Like, that's I think one of the things I am saying about this whole film is, like, these conversations have been happening for a long time. And if you are new to the conversation, that is not the conversation's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's your fault, because you haven't been listening. Specifically, I'll speak as a white person, right? White people have not been listening to persons of color who have been saying all of this kinds of stuff literally since Emancipation and before. Mm-hmm. Go back and look at W.B. Du Bois. Go back and look at any of the emancipators early on. Go back and look at any one of the civil rights movement. I mean,
even current civil rights people like Frederick Douglass, who is totally still alive, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. he's getting very popular these days, I think, because of all the good things he's saying.
I heard he's got a book coming out.
Yeah. So, I mean, for real, like, I'm not trying to be flip when I say that. I mean that one of the clear commands of character commands in scriptures is quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. Mm-hmm. And so white people, especially, like, literally just try to start doing that. Try to start listening a lot, mm-hmm. and shutting our pie holes and doing everything we can not to get angry when we hear things that challenge our whiteness, that challenge our complacency in systemic sin and systemic evil. Mm. And if you don't understand, then by all means, definitely. Like, if you hear what someone else says and you think that doesn't make any sense, then don't get mad. Work harder to understand them.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Right. And I think what we tend to do is when we don't understand someone, or we think, how could they do that? Or how could they say that? We just go ahead and get angry instead of working to understand them. And that is the literal opposite of what scripture commands us to do. Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. So where does my faith play into that as a white male in this time? That's a big part of it. And I think I said that on the Get Out episode. Like, mm-hmm. I have tried to fill my social media feed and my bookshelf with voices of color. And I've tried to just listen. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning a lot about my own complacency. And mm-hmm. it's making it more and more difficult for me to just ignore it because it doesn't cost me anything.
Mm-hmm. So would you, to play kind of devil's advocate, not that I don't think that's great advice, but would you make a distinction between listening and then automatically agreeing with everything?
Oh, sure.
Because I think one of the pushbacks I got after the Get Out episode were people, not many, I make it sound like there was this whole like crowd of people who were upset about this. But you know, just one or two people kind of honestly inquiring, like, hey, you know, JR said that, you know, he listens to a whole bunch of, prominent black thinkers and activists, and if they say something because they're black, do I automatically assume that they're more informed and thus I should just accept what they say? Where's the balance in that?
Well, I would say, how can we just give a blanket rule about here's the balance?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
What I would say is, try for a few months privileging the voices of color and mm-hmm. assuming that if you disagree with them, maybe they are actually right, instead of assuming maybe they are actually wrong.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
And just start from that assumption and see what happens if you give voices of color the benefit of the doubt, instead of giving my own white privileged voice the benefit of the doubt. What, like, just see what happens.
Can I throw in a couple things here?
Yeah.
So one of the things that, because obviously I'm not white, so, but
obviously,
you know, it took me a challenge to first understand what privilege meant. And I should say social privilege, because privilege is not something that's something that stops the conversation for some people right at the front door, because a lot of people think it's something that you have to actually work for or you inherit or whatever. And it's not the material sense of the term. It's really a matter of just perspective and worldview, right? So, you know, it took me a moment to understand the concept of privilege. And this is how I engage with my white friends who don't or didn't get it, by saying, hey, we're both men. We have male privilege. There are certain things that we don't have to think about or that don't affect us, but they do for our female counterparts. And if you can understand that, the fact that you'll never think about what it's like to have a period, the fact that you'll never have to worry about what birthing pains feel like, the fact that you rarely, unless you're like some supermodel, ever have to feel about being, you know, sexually objectified, that's a privilege. Mm-hmm. It's nothing you work for. It's something that just happens. due to our structure of society. So if you can understand what male privilege is like, then you can understand what white privilege is like in America. So, you know, that's the first part that you got to get to. But definitely tying into what JR was saying, I literally made a post of this, and I called it the unity formula, right? And it's like a five-step process in how you can really bridge those gaps. Because everyone is always talking about, we want that unity. We want to bridge that racial divide. And JR touched on a couple of them where he said, the first one is listening. You know, just like the scripture says, like, you should listen first. Once you listen, that's when you can start to understand, which is the second step. And a lot of people get caught up in that because they get caught up in, wait a minute, this person said something that offended me, and now I'm just going to shut down. Well, now maybe you should go back and listen some more, you know, until you understand. And when you do understand, that's where I would add on to what JR was saying and say, this is where empathy slash love comes in. So if we're bringing the scripture into it, you should not just love your neighbor, but love everyone, love your enemy even, love those that you think are opposing you. And when you do that, that's when you can really start to put yourself in their position, you know, and really start to not just understand what they're feeling, but just literally feel what they're feeling, you know, and then you can speak on it. Then you can share your thoughts. Then you can ask your questions, because you don't always have to agree. But at least if you come from a place of understanding and empathy, now we can really start to have a constructive conversation. And the biggest piece that tends to get left out is the final piece, which is relationship. You know, we are made to be relational creatures. God did not want us to be alone. Mm-hmm. So one of the most impactful things that we can do is build relationships with people, because that's what sustains that empathy. It sustains the understanding. It sustains the fact that we're always going to listen to each other, you know, and we can keep that dialogue going. So when you have that, I think, encompasses a lot of the Christian teachings anyway. And it does kind of help us, you know, break out of our bubbles and I'm sorry, but, you know, your random black friend at work doesn't count. Like, you need an actual friend, you know.
What about the article that I found from Condoleezza Rice?
That doesn't count either. You know, unless you know Condoleezza personally. That's different.
I don't.
That is different. So, you know, that's just something that, you know, especially if we're talking about, you know, Christian values and the scripture. I mean, like, those are all things that I think should be emphasized and just reflected upon when we're having these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I will plug one of my personal favorite theologians, like I usually do, but I really appreciated what Tim Keller posted in response to the Charlottesville thing, kind of like things that we as Christians should be doing. And it's because of basically what he encouraged people not to say. And it was like, you know, we Christians should look at the things that are happening and look at an energized and emboldened white national movement. And it's like very awful slogans, and just condemn it. Like, stop. Like, not be like, but not all people are like that, or but that's not everyone, or but there are good people on both sides. Like, nothing like that. Just, it's wrong. And my faith compels me to condemn that. And and then, like, something, and then his second and third points, I feel like, go hand in hand, which are, you know, in most of the churches that I'm aware of, or that I have friends that go to, all of them, to some degree or another, spoke out on Sunday morning from the pulpit against the white nationalism that happened in Charlottesville. He was saying, but, you know, it should happen. It should be one of our regular things that we're talking about. Like, we should regularly, just like we talk about all sin, like, the sin of racism is something that we should be regularly talking about. Especially when it's this prevalent in society, because if we don't talk about it, much like lots of the other sins that we don't really give a lot of credence to, you know, because like I said, there is rarely a sermon about gossip, you know, like that's all, you know, gossip and gluttony and things like that.
Yeah.
Like people don't talk about those sins from the pulpit very often. I'm not saying that you can't find a sermon about it, but it's not very common. And so those, right. So people, when you don't hear people talking about what the Bible says about those sins, you start to go, oh, those sins must not be that bad because my pastor never talks about it. I never hear about it on Sunday. And he's saying we need to, that needs to be in the rotation. Like when the scripture comes up and it deals with it, we need to deal with it. Not pretend like it's something that we fixed.
And I think even beyond that is probably insisting that we stoke the fires of our moral imaginations so that we can see more places that the scriptures actually speak to racial harmony and the good of diversity. I think it is an indictment on the white evangelical church, how badly we have let politics of the nation define the politics of the church.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And it is because I think we have such a poor imagination that we can't see the diversity of the early church, that we don't take seriously what it means to say that Gentiles being welcomed into the church was a racial issue. I mean, there's so many places that, and again, I would say specifically that is a privileged way of reading the text.
Absolutely. Right?
That we as white Christians have never been trained to look at the racial issues that are everywhere in the scriptures. There are not many places that you can get away from economic issues in the scriptures. And yet we, particularly white Christians, think that the Bible is all about how I personally get to go to heaven when I die.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. That's a very good point. Very good point.
Well, lots of times what's that phrase? Most of the sermons to the white, suburban church come off as like what, moral therapeutic deism, instead of actually making people realize, like, even in the suburbs, sin is real and we need to deal with it.
I mean, I've had in recent weeks, I've had like honest to goodness, real conversations with people online about whether or not Jesus was political. And I'm like, he got crucified by Rome.
Right.
That is a political execution. And they kept pushing back on me, being like, name one place he was political. And I was like, is this real? Am I being punked? Yeah. Like, this is insane. But again, it's because white evangelicalism is so privatized spirituality that we can't imagine how it has anything to say about culture, about society, about politics, in ways that are actually fundamentally, essentially different from a particular political line, you know?
Well, I think that's really interesting because I find more and more that, I think you said something to the effect of like, you know, we're letting like basically our politics define kind of like our faith or our theology. I do believe that's the reverse of what should be happening, because I think more and more as I see people of faith or people of different faiths and people of faith that maybe even look like Christianity, but I still like disagree with, almost everyone is getting more active politically. And now you can almost choose your church based on political party,
right?
Yeah. As opposed, I mean, like you have,
wow, really?
Heck, even, you know, the church that I'm a part of, there's basically like a liberal branch that people think everyone's just social justice warriors and aren't Orthodox anyway. And then then they would say that the other side of it is, you know, a bunch of fundamentalists who aren't, you know, don't care about the society around them and are navel gazing, you know, white evangelicals that don't care about the world, you know, so like there's mud thrown both ways, but all these people are getting political, you know, like you have pictures of people, post riots, post, post police shootings, post, you know, all these terrible events, and sometimes even during, if it's like a protest, of pictures of people of faith coming together. And lots of times the people writing articles on behalf or putting themselves out front are the ones that are part of more liberal movements, ones that are championing more social justice causes, more progressive social justice causes, for good or bad. And then, you know, you have the stereotype of what I think you're mostly describing, JR, which is, you know, the historical white evangelical church, at least since, you know, the days of Jerry Falwell and stuff, where it became synonymous with a conservative America, a non-progressive, a non-liberal kind of theology. So I do agree that Jesus was incredibly political, but I'm very curious in all this preamble how we let how we reverse that. How, instead of going, I'm going to go to that church because I know they do lots of social justice things, or I'm going to go to that church because I know that they're against this thing that I don't like. Like, how does the gospel help you be political? I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, yeah, because my church, Catalyst Church, where I pastor, we have folks in metaphorical pews. We have chairs. We have folks in the pews from all political stripes. And we're not quiet about that. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't all just agree to disagree. Like, we actually, like, in person, in our small groups, in sometimes even online, we'll have some pretty pointed debates and conversations about issues like this. And that is something mm-hmm. that I celebrate as often as possible from the pulpit.
The diversity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I say, like, every we do a monthly, like, new to Catalyst kind of luncheon for folks, where people can just come and kind of figure out what the church is about. And I celebrate it there loudly. And, what I basically tell them is that we believe that diversity, in this way, a diversity of thought actually makes us a stronger church. And our goal as a church is not like, oh, well, you know, we're a young church or we have a lot of new folks and eventually we're all going to see eye to eye on all this stuff. We say, no, actually, we think that these are all really difficult, complicated issues, and we want to preserve a plurality of voices. And I go back to Jesus's selection of the 12. Mm-hmm. He had Matthew the tax collector and Simon the zealot, and you could not get more politically diverse than that. And I would love to have been sitting around the campfire some nights when those two got talking politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it had to have just been really tense, and yet Jesus calls them both to be in his, you know, two of his 12 tribes.
But there's got to be some balance between, like, because I would say the same thing about our church. Like, I love the fact that, like, especially in our particular church, like, liturgy is very heavy, and liturgy typically ends up being the great equalizer. So it is easy to see someone who's very Republican and very Democrat sitting in the same pew, aka, you know, just chairs, on Sunday morning. But there's got to be some kind of fine line between saying it's great that we have people on both sides of the spectrum without also reinforcing that some parts of each spectrum are not equal. Like, it's not okay for some things to be, you know, equally lauded.
Well, okay, so, like, to kind of go back to your previous question about, like, you know, what can we do, especially with the gospel, right? And I think it's one of those things where I think it was C.S. Lewis that said, you know, a man usually has to be reminded more so than he has to be taught, right? So I think that needs to apply with the gospel. I mean, one time I remember recently, when the issue was about healthcare, you know, about whether it should be universal or not. And I've got some pretty conservative-minded colleagues. And I remember asking them something. I was like, you know, well, you know, you're a fellow Christian, right? And he was like, well, yeah. And I was like, well, you know, what's your thoughts on, you know, healthcare? You know, do you think that everyone should have it or not? And he was like, oh, well, you know, they everybody should be responsible for themselves. And, you know, I shouldn't have to pay for someone else if they don't want to take care of them and all this. And I'm like, so how does that gel with your Christian values and principles?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm like, seriously, I'm really trying to understand, what are you saying? Jesus had the similar mindset? Because I think we'd have far less miracles in the Bible if that were the case. You know, and so I'm just like, you know, that kind of reminder. And it was funny because when I mentioned it, you could kind of see that whoa, you know, type of moment in their face, where like the cognitive dissonance like strikes, you know, and it becomes apparent because it doesn't gel with the gospel. And I think a lot of times when people go into that political mode, but want to tout the Christian, you know, banner at the same time, that's when we need to jump in there and be like, ooh, so, you know, Jesus taught this though, right? You know, Jesus was welcoming of neighbors, and remember that whole Good Samaritan thing, but you're advocating the travel ban. Can we talk about this for a second? You know, So, you know, I think reminding people about Christ's message, and, you know, this also kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, Mikey, about because these things don't get mentioned, it's almost like, oh, because this isn't like the top lesson to be learned, maybe it's not so bad. I don't have to focus on it. You know, I mean, being a Christian is pretty tough if we really were to stick to everything, You know, that we really need to, that we're commanded to. I mean, it's not easy to love people through disagreements. You know, that's very difficult. And that's what politics introduces, you know, Introduces people to different ideologies. But if you're going to be Christian about it, you've got to learn how to love them through that. And not just the fake love, like, oh, I hear you, but I'm just waiting to disagree with you.
I'll be praying for you.
Exactly. You know, nothing like that. But it's really like, hey, you know what? I love you so much that while I might not agree with you, I'm still going to work with you and find some common ground. You know, because that is part of love, is, you know, compromise is an aspect of love in some situations. So, you know, I think that constant reminder, you know, because the Bible does tell us that we are supposed to hold one another accountable, you know, when we do see our brothers or sisters straying. So we got to remind each other that kind of stuff, you know, when we see it.
Well, I think that's one of the toughest parts because, yeah, I similarly just had a conversation on social media. I think the lesson, as usual, when we get into conversations like this is social media usually isn't the greatest place to have this. Yeah, that doesn't deter any of us. So, you know,
not at all.
It's much more difficult to do on social media than in person, for sure.
Absolutely.
It's not impossible, but it is more difficult.
So, you know, someone
much more patience is required.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you know, and it's usually hard because when someone posts something on social media, they're not typically saying it to start a conversation. They're doing it because they are doing their duty to inform everyone else of a thing,
right.
which is very tough. And so admitting that up front, seeing someone recently in my social media feed criticize like the Pope because he said something again about how countries should be opening their borders to refugees because it's the thing to do. And saying that that's not safe, and two, saying that, well, I'll accept refugees when the Pope accepts refugees and the Pope's not behind the walls in his Vatican with his guards. And I wanted to go grab some of those memes that JR liked so much, you know, and talk about
like a good meme battle.
Yeah. Talk about false equivalence and things like that. And not to mention that, like, with a quick Google search, you can see that actually the Pope has actually taken refugees into the Vatican City. But seeing the different, like, people disassociate things or explain things away for their own safety and their own just self-sustaining, their self-interest. And I get, and I think I would be remiss to mention that the things that you've specifically mentioned, E-Man, and some even the things I'm mentioning now, like people can make a case. I don't agree with it, but they can make a case that there's a very different purpose of the government and then our personal responsibility to someone. And I think they do have different purposes, but I think we are still the ones driving the government. So I almost always advocate lack of safety over humanitarian. Like if you're telling me that I'm going to guarantee like 1,000 people that they're going to have a chance to live, like actually going to have a chance to live because I let them in our country for the small chance that one of those might be a terrorist, I'm still taking that chance every day.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, one thing that I think, you know, if we are challenging people with scripture or, you know, just the gospel, I mean, you know, the one thing that comes to mind is that, you know, fear drives a lot of the political agendas nowadays, you know, like, oh no, someone's gonna come and rape and murder your kids, and you know, like,
oh, you must be talking about the Mexicans.
Oh, those two, yeah, them,
yeah,
two.
Yeah, obviously.
But you know, first of all, obviously, we're not given a spirit of fear, so we shouldn't be slaves to fear. Mm-hmm. That's first and foremost. But then, beyond that, we also have to understand that, we can't. How could I put it? It reminds me of the parable of the rich man, you know, and the one who wanted to follow Jesus. And the biggest issue that he had was that he didn't want to give up his possessions. You know, he didn't want to be uncomfortable. So are you guys still there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're
okay,
tracking.
Okay. No, I'll go for it. Yeah, he didn't want to be uncomfortable. And like, that is the price of being a Christian. You have to be uncomfortable with certain things to literally follow Christ. And if you're not willing to do that, then you're only doing it in name. And that's something that I think we always need to be reminded of. I mean, I can't tell you how many things, you know, what's the saying? Like, you know, they're the bad things that we do or the things that we want to do. But, you know, kind of like what Paul was saying, you know, what I don't want to do, I do, and what I shouldn't do, you know, so on and so forth. So, you know, we have to be reminded that, you know, if you're uncomfortable with this, you got to think about what is the cost? You know, like you said, I'd rather be a better human being and show compassion and love to another human being than succumb to the fear of the small possibility that that other person or I'm opening the doors for some other issue. You got to just take that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and so it's very tough when you, like I said, again, you have these conversations because fear is real. And there is, you know, there is wisdom, I think, in safety. I think, you know, like we're not called to be like irrational. We're not called to be careless. But you know, it's almost like the Spider-Man thing, you know, with like great responsibility, with great privilege, with great possessions, with great freedom. I think we're called to more. And I can't read the Gospels and think that if we are truly following Christ, that it's not going to hurt.
Right.
I'm not saying that like our life is going to be like every day, every minute of the day in harm's way, like putting our life on the line. I mean, some people are going to have a life that's called to that, but I don't think that we're ever really supposed to be comfortable. I think if you're comfortable, you're probably not doing it right. Not because like being a Christian equals misery, but it should be a struggle, like to actually do the thing that's right. Because almost everything in us is fighting to do the things that are wrong.
Or easy.
Yeah. Which is usually wrong.
Right.
So it's, you know, being in the culture that we're in. So this is where I want to almost throw it to you. So you can say this thing that I feel like you've said on multiple episodes, JR, but, when we're in a position of privilege, like equality feels like a loss, right?
Yep. it's experienced as loss. It's yeah, it feels.
Yeah, when you're already on the positive side of things, making things equal means that you have to, you know, be knocked down a couple notches.
Or you can step down a few notches.
What? Mm.
Bananas.
So I think.
Well, and can I just jump in right there?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I want to make sure that it's clear, as we've been talking about the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville and Just Say No to Nazis and all of that. And then we're all at the same time saying, listen to people and give them the benefit of the doubt and things like that. I feel pretty strongly that I understand where these white men who march in Charlottesville and Boston until they got embarrassed are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
They see a world where up until very recently, the only voices that mattered were white male voices, like
mm-hmm.
theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And now, increasingly, many, many other voices are being brought to the table.
Yep.
Now, objectively, that's obviously a good thing. But what it feels like to a white male is that no one cares what we think anymore.
Right.
Because all of a sudden, whereas it used to just be, I would say something and that was how it was, now we have to say, well, that's nice. Let's hear from everyone else. And it feels somewhat dismissive. And it feels like, again, it feels like a loss of cultural position and power. Now, again, that's what it feels like. That's not what it is.
Right.
But that's what it feels like to the people who are in my position who used to have all of the seats at the table. Right. In order for other people to have seats at the table, that means some of us have to get up and give up those seats. And we haven't wanted to do that. So sometimes the seats are being taken away and it's being experienced as loss. It's not loss. It's equality. It's justice. Right. But it's right. What it feels like. And so that is the source, I think, of much of this white rage that we're seeing in our culture. And I get it. I think it's wrong. I think it's sinful. I think it's actually covering up a lot of insecurity and shame and ignorance, but it is anger. And I think
fear.
If we don't. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Fear.
Yeah. And fear. Yeah. What we don't understand, I keep saying we, cause I think I understand these guys. What we don't understand is that justice is better than injustice. And, I wrote about in my little weekly newsletter that I do, the one I put out after Charlottesville, I talked about the Magnificat, the song that Mary sings after she finds out she's pregnant with a Christ child. And she sings that God is going to fill up the hungry, but send the rich away empty handed. And she's going to lift up God's going to lift up the humble and pull down the powerful from their thrones. And I was like, the problem with this song for me is that I look a lot more like those people on thrones than I do like Mary. So like for a long time, I got how the Magnificat was good news for Mary because she's poor, female, racially disadvantaged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if I'm locating myself in the world of the first century, I'm a lot more like Pontius Pilate than I'm like Mary. Right. So that song felt like bad news for me. And I had to work through that and understand how a God who is most essentially self-giving love, shout out to my Wesleyan theology roots, how a God who is most essentially self-giving love could intend a song like the Magnificat to be good for both Mary and Pontius Pilate, right? And the answer to that I found is that it's justice. And so I don't have to be afraid, E-Man, back to your comments, right? I don't have to be afraid because I can trust that the one who is enacting this justice, the one who is pulling me down, or in a best case scenario, if I am really trying to follow the God who gave up his divine privileges and took the form of a slave, stepping down from that throne, I can trust that this one is working ultimately all things for the good of those who are called according to his purpose.
Hmm. Amen.
Well, and as a wise man once said, something totally serious that I'm going to say right now, fear leads to anger and anger leads to Charlottesville and Charlottesville leads to suffering.
Yeah.
Loose paraphrase.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, You know, look, just to kind of bring it back to Detroit a little bit.
Thank you.
I mean,
that movie that we,
the movie that the whole show is based on.
That's right.
You know, just the whole Charlottesville, the whole, you know, because at some point Detroit was Charlottesville, right? Mm-hmm. At some point Detroit was Ferguson. So, what I really hope people understand is that it shouldn't take these extreme wake up calls to wake up. You know, that's the part that I think becomes more frustrating, because I was almost saddened when I'm looking at my social media timeline and I'm seeing a lot of my white friends that are like, oh my gosh, I'm shaking, or I'm crying, or I can't believe this. And I'm just sitting here like, this shocks you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it took this to shock you? Have you not seen any of the news in the past 10 years?
Yeah.
You know, like, where were you then? Where was your shaken outrage and uncomfortability at that point? But, you know, we can't allow ourselves to get to this point where we see a riot like in Detroit, or we see protests. And like, if neo-Nazis is what it takes for you to wake up, something's wrong.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, so it's like when I, well, at least I assume I'm hearing you correctly. The I'm listening to like NPR, like I think the next day, and they're like interviewing the mayor of Charlottesville, and he said something to the effect, again, I'm paraphrasing, like, hopefully now people will what did he say? It was something like, hopefully now people will see, or if this doesn't bring people together, then what will, or something like that. Or if this doesn't make people realize, then what will. And I was listening to that and I'm like, but I mean, like, there have already been terrible things. Like, you could have said that exact phrase about so many things that have happened in the past 20 years. Like, it actually kind of depressed me a little, because I said, yeah, this is what people are going to say now. This is my social media feed now. But then something's going to happen in the next two or 3 weeks, and people are probably going to forget about this.
Yep.
Forget is a strong word. I don't think people will forget about this, but people will move
on. They won't prioritize it.
Yeah. And they'll be like, well, that was a thing that happened, and it really was sad. I mean, just like they did with, you know, many of the...
Slavery?
Yeah.
You know, Jim Crow.
Dang.
So if there is a really brilliant article, and it's really more like a novella, or not a novella, I guess, like a short nonfiction book, whatever that's called, that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote in The Atlantic several years ago, called The Case for Reparations.
Yeah.
And if you are listening to this and you're still struggling to understand how slavery has anything to do with Detroit or Charlottesville, I would highly recommend you carve out a couple of hours and read that article, because it is thorough. Coates is an incredible journalist. It is incredibly thoroughly researched, and it traces a direct line from emancipation through Jim Crow, through the Great Migration North, to today.
Hmm.
And demonstrates how persons of color, especially African Americans, have been systematically denied equal rights since emancipation and on through to today. And then offers some ideas about how systemically, as a country, we could begin to make those things right.
Well, unfortunately, everyone knows The Atlantic is fake news, so there's no reason to really go do that.
Yeah.
Also, again, I've never owned slaves personally, so it's probably not going to help me at all understand anything. So,
yeah,
more sarcasm just to lighten the episode. So, like usual, if you will make sure that I have a link to that, then I will put it in the show notes. And I appreciate E-Man trying to get us back on the Detroit. But that's what I love about movies like this. This is why I was excited. I mean, I was a little bit bummed after I left Detroit, because when I left Detroit, I realized it wasn't as good as I wanted it to be. It wasn't I wouldn't have rated it as highly as it was getting rated at places like Rotten Tomatoes and things like that. But I just kept thinking, you know, man, what great conversations this can start. Like so many movies that we see that don't necessarily make the point themselves, but are so entrenched in the topics that we need to talk. If you can all share that space, share a movie like Detroit, when you leave Detroit or when you finish watching Detroit, you can all say, okay, what do we need to talk about? And then you can have conversations, I think, that have more weight or are more important to be having, like the conversation we're having now, even if lots of the stuff we're talking about didn't happen in the movie Detroit. Like I said, I think it's a great springboard to have those conversations. So we are about at that point in the show where we need to start winding down. So I'm going to still give us a chance to do come on moments and favorite moments. So, JR, like I said, I know we've kind of nitpicked, but we've I think laid some pretty valid criticisms at the feet of Detroit. But what in your mind was the thing that kind of was probably the biggest disappointment or kind of made you say come on during the film itself?
It was honestly really early in the film when they switched from the riot to the main story. And I was like, that's it. That's what you're going to do with the riot. Mm-hmm. Come on.
Just to kind of like look back at that, was it, would you have just preferred them to not include that at all? Like how could they have done it better with not making this movie? Because the movie's like 2.5 hours long. It didn't really feel like 2.5 hours, thankfully. At least to me.
I don't know. Again, that's why I think in some ways this film was sort of just a fundamentally flawed project.
Mm.
Because it wanted to offer a window into race relations through this injustice that was never righted, but in doing so it failed to situate it in a way that's systematic. So we walked out of there just saying like, man, if it wasn't for those bad cops, this would have never happened.
Yeah.
And if that's the point the film was trying to make, it's just wrong. If that's not the point the film was trying to make, then it failed, in my estimation, to do that entirely.
Yeah.
Because, again, as someone who has family and many friends who are police, this is not about good police and bad police. This is about systemic race issues in America.
Right.
Yeah. So I think both of us would agree with that. So, E-Man, like I said, yeah, whatever was the thing that annoyed you the most or just made you say, come on.
Okay, so, I mean, JR touched on it. We touched on it earlier.
Yeah.
It was definitely the intro and the portrayal aspect. And there's a more critical point I want to get back to about that. But the other thing that I didn't really, I don't know, it kind of made me eye roll a little bit, was what felt like the injection of modern day progressive liberalism.
Yes.
In the 60s. Yeah. Like there was a scene where, you know, where one of the characters is all bloodied up and he's approaching, you know, some police officers, and the officer's like, oh my gosh, what human being would ever do this? And I'm just like, wait a minute, are you serious? Like, do you mean to tell me in a riot situation that's been going on for weeks, where there have been racial tensions, whether you're a racist cop or not, doesn't really matter. There have just been really high tensions. You mean to tell me that that's the very first response that a police officer that's white is going to have of a black person that's running towards them covered in blood? It just didn't feel genuine. And one of the issues that I have, because this also happened in Hidden Figures as well, one of the problems that I have is when film directors interject today's version of what's politically correct in a time setting where that was non-existent. There are certain, I'm not saying that every single white person in the 1960s was racist. Not saying that at all. What I'm saying is, if you're going to stay true to the time, they're going to say things that we're not going to find acceptable, but at that time, it was better than what everybody else was doing. So that's something that I thought that the director kind of lost sight in. But I get it. She was trying to also dispel the notion that this isn't a cop issue, that there are some good cops, there are some bad cops, and that overall the system is problematic and it's never changed. But yeah, that's one thing that really stuck out to me. And I know this was like in one of our pre-conversations, one of the Variety article about should white filmmakers tell black stories. And I know that, you know, I don't know if you guys have gotten in these conversations with other people, but I've seen a variety of responses to that. And I think, well, first of all, I mean, what do you guys think about that? Or did you guys get to read the article or not?
I was going to say, I actually forgot to ask that question. That was one of the question.
I mean, do you guys have any thoughts on that first?
I would say my initial thoughts are there is part of me to put like all my cards on the table that automatically doesn't like when someone tells me that. Like I got very, very snooty artistic about it. When people started talking about Wonder Woman, like, oh, thank God there was like a woman director, 'cause she's going to do Wonder Woman right. And I'm like, so does that mean like the inverse is like only like white males can tell like white male stories? Mm-hmm. Like only white dudes can direct like Captain America. And I mean, like, I'm excited, that we're getting, the Black Panther from the guy that I
Ryan
should.
Ryan Coogler.
Yes, Ryan Coogler, because I think Ryan Coogler has done amazing work. Like, it's probably because he has some kind of insight into the stories that he's been telling to this point, and I'm hoping that continues to carry through with Black Panther. But I there's a part of me that instantly argued that it should be the person who can tell the story best. But honestly, like I said, if I take a step back from that initial reaction, I wouldn't say that it's a hard rule, but I do think that if movies are about telling good stories, then the people that are probably going to be the best storytellers are the people who have been telling those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least know how to tell those stories the best. And in almost every case, it's going to be someone who is of a particular race or gender to the story that's being told. And so I don't think, I still reject the idea of it being a hard line, but I can see evidence of where I think this movie would have been better if it wasn't Kathryn Bigelow that was making it.
And Mark, I said Ava DuVernay, if she had done this, it would have been 10 times better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, and as I said, like, as much as I want to like disagree with the premise, I wouldn't argue with that statement.
Yeah.
So
I think in general, I think that it is possible for people. I mean, this is a conversation in the writing community all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Are you allowed to write opposite your gender or against your race? Is that even something that should be attempted? And the general consensus is, yeah, you should, particularly if we actually want books that are diverse. You know, if you want a cast like in a fantasy world to be different races, or just in general in fiction, there should be a way that creators can, to a degree, get out of their own experience. And I think as much as I've been down on this film and as much as I've said, I think it is 5 years too late and missed the boat on a bunch of stuff. I prefer that it exists to not existing.
Yeah.
Because I think one of the things that privilege affords those of us who are privileged is the opportunity to kick open doors, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we had so many superhero movies actually opened the door for someone to finally give a female director a blockbuster property.
Yeah.
And I mean, that never should have been the case, but it was the case. And so the fact that we had so many white guys making superhero movies actually opened the door for the Ryan Cooglers and who directed Wonder Woman? Patty Jenkins, to be able to do that. Right. And so I think that the fact that Kathryn Bigelow, who is an Oscar award winning director, took on this story, hopefully at least will demonstrate that people want to see films like this.
Yeah.
And now it will maybe be easier for a person of color who wants to tell this kind of a story to get the funding to do that, because she took a big risk. And it was a big risk at the end of the day.
I was going to say, I don't actually think the film is doing all that well.
No, but it's got great critical acclaim. Yeah. And, you know, it's gonna sweep up during awards season. I mean, like, right, like, so on these kinds of films don't always get measured on those same metrics, right? Yeah. And so I think that there is something of that. And I think about that with my own position as a white male in the evangelical church. Like, how can I create spaces for women, for persons of color, by leveraging the privilege that I have? You know, like, what can, how can I? And in fact, example for me, there's the president of Tribeca Nazarene Seminary, which is in my denomination.
Mm-hmm.
This guy named Dan Boone. He's one of our premier theologians in our denomination. And he has told me on multiple occasions and has said this publicly elsewhere. He says at the point where I'm in my life, all I'm trying to do is kick open as many doors for you younger clergy as I can.
Yeah.
And make as much space for you as I can in the leadership structures of our church. And that's what I think, that he has a tremendous amount of privilege in our denomination. And he's trying to leverage it for people like me who have less. Right. And I think that, I think that is what we always should be doing mm-hmm. when we have privilege. And mm-hmm. so I think that that's what I see Bigelow. That is at least a good I see Bigelow doing.
A byproduct of, yeah.
And I think that is something. And again, from all accounts, she was incredibly collaborative, you know. With persons of color on the set and throughout the process. So it's not like she just like showed up, made this movie and went home. Like, I think she did the best that she could and was aware of the issues going into it. So I think she is a model for, if you're going to try to do something like this, here's a way to do it.
Let me step in right there.
Do it.
So my thing on this, and I'll try and make this quick, 'cause I know we're wrapping up here. I absolutely agree with what Mikey was saying in terms of that there is no hard line for this, right? Like, I have no problem with people making or telling stories of other social groups as best as they can. And I mean, first of all, I think it's an indicator of the fact that we don't have enough black filmmakers in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, that's a problem, you know, because while I do believe that Ava DuVernay would have been great, she was busy doing another film. You know, and again, who had the time to make this story? So while it's great that Bigelow was able to tell this story, my bigger contention is this. I have no problem with her making this. I do have a problem with the fact that there was absolutely no person of color in the creation or in the filmmaking process.
Yeah,
that's great that you go and talk to the people that are supposed to be the actors. But that doesn't help with the actual production of the film when your director is white your writers are right and every producer is also white. Because yeah. now that's how something like the introduction and the rioting stuff, that's how that slips through. Because yep. no one is going to see any issue with it. Because we all have these cultural blinders. And that, you know, that happens. I mean, I'm a straight, heterosexual, you know, black man. If I want to make a movie about white gay men or whatever, I at least would like to have someone on my staff so that when I'm making this film, they can at least be like, ooh, this representation that you're doing here, that's not cool. You know, or you should change this perspective a little bit or something of that nature. It just reminds me of like The Color Purple, directed by Spielberg. You know, however, you had Alice Walker, you know, with the content. So you had a black person doing the content. And you also had like someone like Quincy Jones as a producer. So make the films. It doesn't matter who you are. But if it is a story of someone of a different social group, have someone in the creative process with you.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my only recommendation mm-hmm. because representation matters. Portrayal matters. You know, we're not telling oral stories. We're telling visual stories. And those visuals can have a bigger impact than whatever you hear in the film, you know. So that's my main thing for it.
No, I think that's completely fair. It's so fair, in fact, that I almost hate to change the subject.
because, I said my piece, so go for it.
Well, he's like, because that's why I wanted to pause there for a second, because my come on moment is like, is me assuming that I completely missed something.
Mm.
To remind everyone that we are still technically doing come on moments. I really don't understand. And I was like, as much as I was on the edge of my seat and it was very tense and, you know, it was like, it was making me bite my nails and sweat, that whole middle section of the film. I really don't understand why, especially after he was unlawfully shot and killed, no one just pointed out that the dude who shot the cap gun one, that it was a starter pistol. No one told him that it was a starter pistol, and no one was like, it was that guy right there.
Right.
Like, it's like there's like some kind of loyalty, or is there the understanding that even if you give the guy what he wants, he's still going to kill everybody anyway or beat everybody anyway? Like, I just felt like that was like an hour and a half of something mm-hmm. that would have been still unfortunate and racist and probably problematic for a lot of things, for a lot of reasons, but it would have been a lot shorter if they could have said, yeah, the dude had a starter pistol. Like,
sure.
What am I missing?
They said a few times that it was just a toy or he had a toy.
Yeah, they tried to.
Okay.
Or like, it wasn't a real gun or something like that.
Well, I thought they said like, I don't even think it was real or, you know, something like that. But it's like, but no one could reproduce the starter pistol to be like, look, this is what he was shooting. Like, and anyway, I
had some of those same questions. After the film was over, I wondered if that was a unfortunate byproduct of the fact that it was based on true events that had not been accurately documented
mm-hmm.
and they were working off of recollections that are at this point nearly 60 years old.
Yeah. And I think that's fair. That's why it was something that bothered me. But like I said, I assume that like, you know, it's a high pressure, tense situation and everything that's rational doesn't always make its way to the top. So, mm-hmm. So super fast. Cause I know we're all not long talkers. Eman, what was your favorite part of this film? Whether it was a character or an idea that came from the film or just like a favorite scene or something.
Well, but my favorite part was really the ending with the judicial hearing. Not because I was in favor of the ruling, of course, not because of that, but I was in favor of the fact that it pointed out that while racial issues happen, you know, you're going to have brutality, you're going to have violence, you're going to have riots. That's not the problem. I mean, it's part of it, but that's not the bigger problem. The bigger problem is when justice is not served. Because as a nation, we put our faith into our judicial system and the laws. However, even all the way back to the 60s, they've never really been changed. Yeah. And that's mm-hmm. where institutionalized racism gets that lens put on it. And I was happy that it was magnified, because if you could be upset that, you know, the officer who was clearly racist and clearly in the wrong got off scot-free, then you really have to question a lot of the most recent killings, you know, of unarmed Black people. If you're upset about what happened in the 60s, but you're not upset about what's going on today, something's wrong. Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm talking about on the judicial side of things. You know, the fear for my life thing is being really abused. The fact that 99% of officers in these shootings are acquitted is a situation we need to look at,
yeah.
especially given the video evidence that we all can see.
Yeah.
So that was the biggest thing that I hope people took away, but I was very happy that they emphasized that in the film.
Yeah, because that's the conversation starter.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Cool. JR, same thing. What did you like?
So it was something that blindsided me. And it's the fact that I'm going to have to look up the main character's name real quick.
Algie Smith?
Algie, yes. He started out, and all he wanted to be was a famous Motown singer.
Yeah.
Right? And at the end of the film, after the court case, he says, I can't sing Motown anymore because it's for them.
Mm.
And he specifically means white people.
Yeah.
Mm.
And this has been, again, going all the way back, this has been a consistent issue. Rock and roll started out as Black music, right? And then white people took it. Hip hop started out as Black music. And now more and more and more, you have people like Eminem, right? Who are being considered like more successful. And I have a couple of friends who are rappers, and they've talked about how like they're afraid that hip hop is going to go the way of rock and roll.
Mm.
Right. That it's going to be taken over by white people.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was interesting, fascinating to me that he left Motown because it was for them, for white people. And the place where he found sanctuary was in the Black church and in Black church music.
Mm.
And that was an aspect of this film that totally caught me off guard.
Well, I would say that was something that really stuck with me too. And it's one of the things that I was like, I assume people are going to wonder if they see this movie and we're having a Real World Theology podcast, like what we're going to talk about. And it was interesting to me also. And probably not my favorite, like it sounds weird to say favorite, right? But just something that like stuck with me was the fact that that was the place that he felt he could still be him.
And again, I think for a lot, there's a lot of conversation in church leadership about, Sunday morning still being the most segregated hour, and you know, what can white churches do to be, but there's also like a pushback by a lot of persons of color who have said, you know, like we need our segregated spaces because it's where we actually are safe. And it is difficult for a lot of persons of color to be a part of white congregations, because there very rarely are congregations truly multi-ethnic. They might be ethnically diverse, but they are in character most often white.
Yeah.
And so there's, again, I've had several friends of color who have shared articles, or just even had conversations where they say, you know, it's very difficult for persons of color, particularly in this climate, to participate in white churches. And so I found it interesting that the film so carefully showed that his journey ended in the Black church, and that's where he actually found safety. That's where he found comfort, and that's where he found a home.
Yeah, I mean, that's what.
And that's just to mention, that was after he was traumatized.
Yeah,
you know, because remember he was forced to sing,
right?
You know, it was almost kind of like a raping, you know?
Yeah,
type of situation. Like, here's that thing that you love. I'm going to force you, you know, to and exploit that. Yeah.
Well, I think it that in and of itself is almost like like I said, something we could probably have an entire other conversation about. But as usual, I'm trying to keep this to a certain length with two things in mind. One, the listener's time. And two, the fact that, like, we're not here to give you every answer about this movie. We're not here to, like, tell you everything that this you should talk about or not talk about. And usually, especially with a movie that gives you springboards like this, this is just the beginning of the conversation. So I want everyone to be able to continue to have these conversations and continue to have conversations that, have weight and importance. And I'm glad that I got to be a part of this one. So, E-Man, thank you. JR, thank you. And I want to make sure people can follow the work that you're doing. So E-Man, like what do you do and where can people find you around the internet?
Hey, look, I'm everywhere and anywhere, right? So, you could check out some of my videos on, actually just go to emansmoviereviews.com. That's where you can check out all my reviews. I write for a bunch of different outlets, but I source everything back to my main page. Or just follow me on social media. My Facebook fan page is probably the best one. That's just Facebook, and then just look up E-Man's Movie Reviews. You know, we talk about movies, trailers, news, put up some funny memes and stuff. Just have a good time, and we can argue. I love arguing. It's always fun.
You mean discussing intensely?
Intense discussions. Yes.
Yeah.
We'll clean it up that way. But yeah, definitely check me out on Facebook, E-Man's Movie Reviews, and can't wait to talk to you all.
Awesome, JR. Same thing. How can people follow what you do?
Yeah. So everything I do, I put into a weekly newsletter. I send out every Friday. I call it Stuff You'll Probably Like. And you can get that at jrforesteros.com/stuff. That includes all my social media links, all the various podcasts I do. And like when this episode will be in there, because it's anywhere I'm a guest also I put there. And then I have a book coming out in November called Empathy for the Devil, as finding ourselves in the villains of the Bible. And all of the news for that is going to be coming all in there as well. So
awesome. And you guys, anyone out there can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by going to realworldtheology.com/support. You can find links to our guests and all the awesome things that they're doing and contributing to the conversations at realworldtheology.com in the show notes. And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. If you do, again, rate the show, give us 5 stars. It's super helpful. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. I was a little apprehensive because anytime I know kind of where the conversation can probably go before we get into it, I want to do it as considerately as possible. And I think that if this has interested you, or if this has angered you to some degree, I think that's actually good. I would actually encourage you, more so than I usually do, to seek out Emmanuel, to seek out JR. Talk to them. They have a lot of thoughts about this. They're really good listeners. And I think that more so than most people that you'll find on social media, they're willing to engage and listen. So like I said, seek them out. Check out the website. And until next time, for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
A little microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2.
Phone check. 1, 2, 1, 2.
Yeah, I think Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
Wait, why?
That's from Anchorman when he's doing a sound check.
Does he say why? I can't remember.
Nope.
Gosh, that... What a cliffhanger.
Do you need to know why?
Well, don't you kind of want to know?
I mean, who in their right mind would deny? Like, if he's borrowing money at a bank, it's got to be a mortgage of some kind. Mm-hmm. And who is going to give someone who bursts into flame at all times money to build any kind of a building?
I mean,
that's just a really bad investment.
He would be, well, I guess someone could offer him insurance, but just at a super high premium, right? And hope that he can control
it. But it's not insurance. We're not talking about insurance. We're talking about a loan.
Well, I mean, but you would just, it would be a requirement of the loan. You'd be like, you have to have fire insurance. And if you care, you don't care, right? Because you're the bank.
No, I mean, you want to get your investment back. And he's young, he's hot-headed, he doesn't have stable employment. It's a terrible investment.
Well, see, I think that's the thing. I don't think you can discriminate on age or hot-headedness, can you?
I think you can if it's a bad investment. If you're not sure you're going to recoup your money, that's the whole point of the bank industry.
Well, but can the bank, like, legally do that?
Oh, what about, we don't know what happened next in the story. Maybe the Human Torch sued the bank for wrongful discrimination.
Hmm. Do you think the Human Torch was ever, like, cornered in a building during some riots and was forced to try to give up his cohorts that were playing
practical
jokes? No,
because he would have just flamed on.
Oh. I like how that was, you were perfectly straight about that. Like, you were just, no. That's the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Nope. I tried so hard. Oh, well.